This is Marketplace Weekend. I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
I want you to think about the last thing, whether it's a song, TV show, movie, whatever, where you knew immediately, oh yeah, that is a hit. It turns out there's some science behind that. And Derek Thompson has written a fascinating new book about this. It's called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek's also a senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Okay, Derek, what's a hit?
A hit is a commercially important success story for a cultural product. So what does that mean? Cultural product, I'm talking about movies, I'm talking about music, I'm talking about television shows, even things like first names and political ideas. And it has to be commercially significant, which is to say that something that just goes really big but has no potential to make anybody any money, I don't really talk about those things as hits.
You go into a lot of psychology in this book, not just economics, but really studying human behavior. And there was one thing that stands out to me early on. Less thinking leads to more liking.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
So there's this great idea from metacognitive psychologists. So metacognitive psychology says, in sort of a hippy-dippy way, we have feelings about our thoughts. We have thinking about our thoughts. Some thoughts feel easy and some thoughts feel hard. So a good metaphor is the idea that, you know, you're walking through a foreign country and all the signs are in a different language and you don't know where you are. And then suddenly out of the blue, you see your friend. And you know your friend speaks your language. And you're like, aha, I can ask you for directions. They would say this is the difference between disfluency, difficulty of thinking, anxiety about thinking, and fluency, ease of thinking. The general rule in metacognitive psychology is that we like things that are fluent. We like songs that are easy to listen to, stories that are easy to follow. But the interesting thing that I found is that the feeling of fluency is strongest when it emerges from its opposite. So imagine that moment in, say, a thriller where you don't know who the killer is and then, aha, you have an idea. You think you know who it is. Or that feeling in like a crossword puzzle where you can't quite think of the word and then, boom, it comes to you. They call this moment the aesthetic aha. And I love this. One of the theories in the book is that we're sort of hunting for this across culture. We want aesthetic ahas from our books, from our radio shows, from our podcasts, from
nice.
Our movies.
That was nice.
Thank you very much. We want these moments of discovery because that's where meaning lives, is in that moment between disfluency, difficulty of thinking, and fluency, that aha.
So I want to illustrate something that kind of grows out of that. And I could ask you about it, but I actually want to do it backwards. So we're going to play three clips of songs. The first one, John Denver, Country Roads. That's on RCA.
Country roads, take me home.
And then Elton John singing Can You Feel the Love Tonight? That's Walt Disney. It's from The Lion King.
Can you feel the love tonight?
Last one, Bob Marley, No Woman, No Cry. That's Island Records.
No woman, no cry. No woman,
Derek, what's happening there?
What's happening here is that you have three songs in three totally different genres, all of which have the same chord structure. So on the one hand, they don't sound anything alike when you just listen to the voice or the timbre or the instrumentation, but they're all doing the same thing. They're all plotting a different route home. And it turns out that across music, we love repetition. We love familiarity, but we like it when it's sneaky. We like it when we don't really expect it. And so to hear an entirely new timbre, an entirely new kind of sound that nonetheless uses the same chord structure, that is beautiful to listen to. That is the right amount of disfluency and fluency, a little bit of anxiety and discovery, but also a little bit of swinging open that door and coming home to familiarity as well.
Familiarity and discovery aren't just resonant, though, in music. I mean, you have something in this book that is explained as the Maya rule. What does that mean?
Maya, M-A-Y-A, most advanced yet acceptable. This was the grand theory of everything from Raymond Loewy, the father of industrial design in the middle of the 20th century. This is a guy who designed the most famous sports car of the 1950s, the modern Greyhound bus. He designed the Coca-Cola fountain, even the interior of the first NASA spaceship. He designed the entire middle of the 20th century. And his concept for how to design for people across the economy with all these different tastes is to say people are torn between neophilia, a love of new things, a need to discover, and neophobia, a love of familiarity, a fear of anything that's too new. And so he was this genius at just designing things that hit this perfect sweet spot of, yes, it's new, but it always reminds me of something else. And I think that this is what a lot of people are trying to do across culture as well. You know, when you're on a radio show, I'm trying to create new ideas that make sure that they hit home for people, that they resonate, to address them with a little bit of familiarity, provide familiar examples. In storytelling, you often find that some of the best, most resonant stories have very predictable structures, whether it's the hero's journey or the classic romantic comedy of they find each other, they fall apart. And so it's this ability to create new products that are overlaid on familiar patterns that is this incredibly successful pattern across the book.
Does the Venn diagram of the two of those things lead to profitability?
I think so, absolutely. I think that even if you look at technology products, for example, there's that great moment in the Steve Jobs movie where Michael Fassbender is looking at the Mac computer and he says, it has to say hello. It has to look like a face, right? They're introducing this crazy new product to the masses, but he needs it to resemble a person. He needs it to have that element of familiarity in order for people to feel comfortable with it. And so once again, in technology, in music, in storytelling, you see the same pattern.
So to get a little meta on you, a lot of your examples come from the world of music in this book. They are examples that I know. I know what those songs we played sound like. Did you do that on purpose?
Absolutely. I mean, you 100%.
You're using the principles in the book?
You can't not, I suppose. And I guess I use them. There's sort of two meta levels. The first meta level is, look, it's a book about popularity. So all of the examples, by definition, have to be familiar. It's very difficult to pick very popular ideas that nobody's familiar with. But second, you know, I am writing a book that is in a genre that a lot of people are familiar with. That is there's a story, then there's some science, and then there's some theory.
I would call this the Malcolm Gladwell genre.
Perhaps it's the Malcolm Gladwell genre, right. But what I try to do from the first introduction and throughout the book is constantly sort of pull back the curtain and say, I know this is that sort of book. But I also don't want it to be just that sort of book. I want to show you when these tricks are dangerous. So that, for example, when repetition in music is used in politics to create sort of musical rhetoric, it's a very, very dangerous thing. That, for example, the very fact that I'm beginning all of these chapters with stories can itself be dangerous because stories can so easily mislead with their anecdotal persuasiveness. So again, even with the genre of the book, I'm trying to deliver something that is familiar, that people know what to do with, but also at some moment says, now let's step back a moment and realize how dangerous some of these principles can be if applied in the wrong situations.
So I think the second half of the book explodes a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You also talk about something that I found really fascinating, which is just like the invention of the teenager.
Yeah.
As a barometer of cool. Because when we think about culture and what is popular, so much of it, certainly now in 2017, comes from teenagers.
We look to the teens to
right.
Tell us what to do.
Hashtag teens.
What's so fascinating about teenagers, the concept, is first of all just how new it is. Obviously, people have been turning 13 and 14 for millennia, but only very recently did it occur to anybody that this was a special thing. The word teenager really didn't even take off in popular culture until in the 1950s and after World War II. So why? And there's sort of three levels that I look at. First, education. Before compulsory education, when teens were basically just farmers on their family farm, there was no need to separate teenager from adult. Once you turn 15 and you can use that hoe, you're an adult. Get out on the farm. So you needed compulsory education in order to create a school area where teenagers could come together and create their own separate culture. The second thing that you needed was for Americans to get rich, for parents essentially to give these teenagers money so that they could be their own consumers and have their own marketing power. The third thing that I think is really interesting is that you wouldn't have modern teenagers without cars. You needed cars to allow teens to basically run away from their parents and form a separate culture.
And let's be honest, to find a place to make out.
And to find a place to make out. And this is exactly it. You have to find a place to make out that isn't, you know, the living room. That's how people dated. The woman would invite the man over to the parlor and he would have an awkward conversation with the parents. Cars were terrifying to parents in the 1920s and 30s, which actually strikes me as really ironic because now, you know, we look at Tinder, we look at Bumble, and we say, God, this is so dangerous, people hooking up online. This is exactly what people were talking about in the invention of the car. The car was the Tinder of its time. So you needed all these things to invent the teenager, and now we just think of it as completely normal that, yes, of course, teens are not children, but they are different than adults.
A lot of this stuff that you talk about, it might not happen at all. I mean, there is just such an element of chance here.
Yes, exactly. And I wanted to make sure that that came out in a way that people could understand that this is not a book called The Formula. My favorite story about chaos and luck in the book is Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock.
When it came out in 1954, it was the B-side to a record. No one really liked it. It got a lot of marketing muscle from the label, but only charted on Billboard for 1 week. But this amazing sequence of events happens. Peter Ford, a fifth grader living in Los Angeles, is a huge fan of this new rock and roll sound, and he buys the album. His father is Glenn Ford, a movie star. And Glenn Ford, Peter's father, invites the director of his new movie, Blackboard Jungle, over to his beautiful house in Los Angeles. And the director, Richard Brooks, is like, well, I need this new jump jive tune to kick off this movie that I'm making. Do you have any ideas for songs that can kick off this movie? So he gives him a bunch of bands by black artists, and he also gives him Rock Around the Clock. Rock Around the Clock plays at the beginning of Blackboard Jungle, in the middle, and at the end. And only after the movie came out did it become the number one song in the country, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one, and eventually the second best-selling song of all time. So there's no formula that tells you, oh, a forgotten B-side played over the credits of the 13th most popular movie of the year will be the biggest rock and roll hit of all time. The only thing that accounts for it is the probabilistic nature of cultural markets. In other words, luck. Some artists just get lucky.
So how does this translate today, where corporations spend a tremendous amount of their time trying to identify what hashtag teens are into? Often it is teens of color. How does that work if you are sitting in the boardroom of a big company?
An interesting example of one way that works sometimes. I went to Republic Records and I watched one of their scouts show me how he sometimes elevates the popularity of one of his new songs. So what he'll do is he'll open up his phone and he'll pull up Shazam, which is this wonderful app that allows you to press a button and you can tell what any song is that's playing over the radio. He went down on his phone. He zoomed in on Victoria, Texas, this tiny little town. And he told me, I asked the radio companies in this area to play this new song, Ride, in Victoria, Texas.
Take off those heels, lay on my bed, whisper dirty secrets while I'm pulling on your hair.
And I can see that lots of people are pressing Shazam when they hear the song. So now what I can do is I can tell local markets, larger markets that are nearby to Victoria, say in Austin and in San Antonio and in Dallas, hey, people in Victoria who are hearing this song are pressing Shazam. You should probably put it on your list as well, on your playlist as well. And so they'll pick it up there. So what he's essentially doing is sort of feeding up popularity by finding a really small network that he can actually control with distribution, where he can actually see an effect. And then he's telling other distributors, I have proof of this song's popularity.
Is what we think of as virality BS?
Yeah, I do think it is. I think that most people think of virality, viral idea spreading, the same way a viral disease spreads, that it spreads from me to you and you to somebody else and that person to somebody else, a lot of one-to-one exchanges. But when data scientists actually look at the spread of a piece of information online, it almost never looks like a viral disease with many, many, many generations of one-to-one sharing. It almost always looks more like a bomb fuse with one or two, a handful of moments of 1 to 1 million broadcasts. And there's lots of examples in the book where I show that all of these videos that we thought went totally viral, in fact, had broadcasters, celebrities, publishers who are responsible for the vast majority of their distribution. And I think this is an important point to make, not merely an academic point that data scientists care about, because, you know,
right, if you're a consumer, it goes to the sort of the idea of authenticity, of like what's really getting to you.
Exactly. And there's so much, you know, I think that at a time when trust in establishment news is declining, that our trust has sort of moved from institutions to peers. And sometimes we'll say, well, I saw that article in a lot of different places, so it's probably real, right? Ubiquity equals veracity. But my point is to say, even that which seems ubiquitous because it was purely an organically viral was almost always distributed by a broadcaster. So look to the broadcaster. Did it come from this right-wing site, this left-wing site, this Russian propaganda site? It's really important to seek out the provenance of information, the provenance of those broadcasts, rather than trust that say, oh, well, because it's everywhere, it's probably viral and therefore correct.
There is one sentence in this book that stopped me cold. the most important source of news and information in the world is Facebook.
It is. There's no question. You're living in an age of such distraction and fragmentation that the individual power of any broadcaster has to be diluted by the sheer number of broadcasters that there are. Facebook is a nation of 1 billion people connected online. It has absolutely incredible effects for the news that people see. You know, Americans have never really been utterly and exclusively interested in news, right? People magazine has always outsold Time. But because we spend so much time on these social networks where news can sort of slip in, we can become sort of accidental news junkies. We're sort of surrounded by news bits even when we don't seek them out. And Facebook is the mechanism by which we are surrounded by those news bits.
You, Derek Thompson, are selling a product.
Mm-hmm.
How much of this book is engineered to be popular?
At the end of the day, with something like a book, which is so private, you know, a movie you make with 1,000 people, a radio show you make with, you know, 12 people or so, a book is you. It's you and an editor, but the vast majority of it is you. And so ultimately, it is an audience of one. And you have to sort of find a way to trust that the voice in your head.
You got to get people to buy it.
You do have to get people to buy it. But it's impossible in the writing of every single word and sentence to constantly think about the amorphous world of buyers that you don't know. All I can do really at the end of the day is trust myself to have a sense of, do I think that these ideas are interesting to me? And then hopefully they will be as interesting to other people as they were fun to write.
Derek Thompson, author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Thank you.
Thank you.